got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, how are you? What's going on?
Wonderful. I am now, according to some people on the internet, a GMO with my Moderna RNA vaccine. So I'm going to ride that one out. So very happy to now be part of the solution.
Yeah, I'm getting mine tomorrow, so you beat me by a day. But what's the deal? Everyone's calling it a gene therapy, and I don't understand how you can call it a gene therapy.
Well, it's not correcting a gene. It's right. What it is it's transient expression is what it technically is. It's not installing a gene. It's using your body's machinery and your body's hardware to express a protein. So it basically uses your body's stuff to make a mimic of what the virus would look like if it was present. So this way, when your real one comes along, your body's already seen it.
It's one of those like political talking points, you know, like for a while during the Iraq war, everyone was talking about freedom fries. It just seems like it has that kind of vibe to it. I don't know where it started, like what group started calling it a gene therapy. But everyone, all the usual suspects are calling it that. I just don't know where it started.
Yeah, me neither. But suffice it to say, it's the beginning of the end of a dark time that finally we'll be able to get things back towards normal. And, you know, folks who have their businesses come back to normal and folks get back in the restaurants and the hotels and, you know, let's just get back towards life as normal again. I can't wait.
Thank God. I agree. Well, in the meantime, let's jump into some stories. We got some good ones going on today. So first up, vasectomies are becoming a political statement. Next, glyphosate on trial in an unequal contest between science and emotion. Can evidence overcome pesticide cancer fears? And then finally, evidence or junk science? Will the Biden administration ban essential pesticides experts say are safe? So first up, Kevin, let's talk about getting the snip snip.
Yeah, well, this is a really good one. So vasectomies are becoming a political statement by Tanvir Ahmed. This was in March 15th, 2021, Genetic Literacy Project. And what it focuses in on are what appears to be a trend in a large number of couples, but the male portion of that, getting vasectomy. So having the vas deferens, the sperm tube, from the testicles to the external environment, cut. And when that's done, you become effectively sterile. You can't produce any sperm that ever make it to the outside world. Where they go, I don't know. But the bottom line is that there's this kind of unusual political feeling that younger and younger people are getting vasectomies. And it's a lot of people in their 20s, a lot of guys in their 30s. They're basically saying, don't want to have kids, don't want. And a lot of this is being done because fears of overpopulation, impacts of humans on the environment. It's kind of from that whole school of the earth would be a great place if it wasn't for the damn people, you know, those folks. And but different countries have different rules. Finland, you have to be over 30 or had 3 kids. In the United States, you have to have a cooling off period, which that never works. You know, like to buy a handgun in Florida, you have to have a 7-day cooling off period. And I can't stay angry that long. So that's, you know, that works. But the big deal was that in France, for instance, this was considered self-mutilation until 2001. And which is rather interesting. And then the first vasectomy, ironically, was performed by a doctor named Harry Sharp in 1899. So this whole movement of vasectomies is becoming more and more prevalent. A lot of them in Australia. It's 1 in 4 men over the age of 40 have had a vasectomy. And globally, it's like 2%. So this seems to be a really unstoppable trend.
You know, I've mentioned on the show that I can be somewhat cynical sometimes. So my first thought is that, you know, the people that are going to get this done are people who do not share my values. And so maybe I shouldn't say anything and just let them do what they're going to do. but on a more serious note, I think this poses some potential problems depending on how popular this gets. And we covered a story from the BBC in July of last year, and they made a note that the population around the globe might very well crash within the next 100 years or so. And it's because of that trend you mentioned, namely you have younger people who are getting wealthy and they're saying, you know, I don't want to do the whole raising kids thing. I'm just going to buy nice cars and party on the weekends. And, you know, over time, this creates a problem, a fertility crash, really. And so I guess overall, I'm kind of concerned that this is contributing to that trend. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it might, but, you know, I only see that happening in certain cultures, in certain parts of the world, right? In other parts of the world, you'll still be going strong. In Africa, it's considered, you know, highly verboten for men to do this because male fertility is thought to be I don't want to say a gem, but a something that belongs to the community. And so there's a lot of thinking that, you know, that, well, certainly some places will not do the same thing. Look what happened in China when they did the one child policy. It created this gigantic bubble in their population, which is a huge group of men that are moving through who don't have mates. In the long run, I suppose these things all kind of even out, but I suspect that a lot of the countries that are opting for vasectomies, like Australia, New Zealand, may have population issues. Even back in high school, I was hoping to get one. my thinking was really different, and I maybe don't agree with myself back then on this, is that I was under the impression that every guy should get one. And think about it. I was hanging around with a bunch of high school losers who were, you know, and I was like, you know what? I don't want any of these people reproducing. And then all of us were, you know, trying to engage in escapades with the opposite sex. And, you know, it was one less thing you'd have to worry about. And if everybody were to get one early, but that was reversible, and that as you aged and as you decided that maybe it was something you needed to do, and maybe, you know, you had a little earning potential going on or whatever, you know, and then you could have the switch flipped. But as it turns out, it's really hard to get a vasectomy reversed. It's I've heard some physicians talk about it as trying to sew jelly to get the two sides of the vas deferens back together. But it's a really interesting question that brings up a lot of weird ethical edges.
Yeah, and like so many things we talk about, there's no great answer. I don't know. Maybe it's just getting older. You start to think a little bit longer term. I don't know. But like one example of what I'm thinking of here is like when you have kids, and there's a lot of research in economics to bear this out. When you have kids, it incentivizes you to not be a dopey high school kid anymore. You know what I'm saying? Because right. you're like, oh, I got this kid at home. I've got a wife or I've got a husband. You know, we need to work together. Like it facilitates bonding. And I think in the long run, that's facilitates stability in a society. So that's the angle that I'm coming at this from. But I don't know. I guess we can leave it there for now. So glyphosate, again, we're going to talk about glyphosate. But I think this is an interesting angle on this really well-worn topic. So tell us about this.
Yeah, I normally wouldn't be terribly excited about another glyphosate discussion, but this was a good one by Jeffrey Cabot. And Dr. Cabot is an epidemiologist and cancer expert who wrote Glyphosate on Trial, The Unequal Contest Between Science and Emotion, Can It Overcome Pesticide Cancer Fears? And this was in Genetic Literacy Project. And he has written a lot on this, a lot of criticism of the meta-analyses and kind of the poor science that's gone into the indictment of glyphosate. And this article I thought was really important because it was a little bit of a side of him that I normally never get. There was an awful lot of empathy and understanding that if we're going to communicate this topic effectively, we have to take on certain strategies. And it was kind of his talk, his foray on a Spanish-speaking media outlet. I don't know if this was a podcast or news or whatever, but he was on a show about the record-breaking $11 billion settlement from Bayer. And he was going to be on after a cancer survivor who attributes her cancer to glyphosate. And she went on first. And the way that he spoke about her was wonderful. He did, you know, he was exactly right. It was nothing but empathy. You know, her story was that she ran a coffee plantation in the 1980s and 90s, wore a backpack sprayer every day with glyphosate and sprayed the stuff everywhere. Years later, she had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and never really attributed it to glyphosate, but it went into remission. And when the IARC proposed that it was a probable carcinogen, she said, ah, bingo, that's it. And so her story was basically having her her search for a cause of her health problem was finally over. It was validated by IARC. And so her very emotional story carried a lot of gravity. And then he came in and talked about the science.
What I want to get into the details of that, you know, her story and having empathy for people, but I'm actually really curious to get your take on his thoughts about interacting with the media, because he opens the story with his comments about not being sure you're going to be treated fairly and not being sure you can know how the story is going to be framed. And are you going to be presented to the public as a scientist who's just looking at the data and trying to come to a reasonable conclusion? Or are you going to be spun as, you know, some industry insider who's been hired as an academic mercenary? You can never be sure of that. Or at least he said he can never be sure of that. So I'm wondering, since you've had some very similar experiences with some certain newspapers, maybe you can offer some insight into that.
Yeah. But this is the point though. And I appreciate where he's coming from here. You know, you can't control what they're going to do to you. You can do a little research. You can try to understand their motivations. When a certain newspaper went after me, they called and asked if they could do an interview. And I thought, oh, thank God they're here to tell the truth. And I'd get to talk to the reporter and he would talk about, you know, all the good things, not cut the ends off of my sentences to reverse their meaning. You can't control that. And so my advice to anybody who gets an opportunity to interact with the media is take it, because you can go into there and fortify yourself in certain ways by talking about the things that are important to you and by showing the empathy for the other person, or explaining how people could be misled. There are ways to really handle it effectively that even if they try to make you look bad, you come off good. But his whole concerns were that he wouldn't be represented fairly, wouldn't have a chance to tell his whole story. You know, we've had Dr. Cabot on the podcast here. I've had him on mine. And, you know, he can take a little time to tell a story because he likes to be thorough and complete. And they didn't give it to him here. His presentation was cut short, but he still felt it was extremely important that he did it because it allowed the science to be heard against a very emotional plea. And will it change anyone's heart or mind? Maybe not, but at least the story was out there.
It's a great point. And I, what I like most about that section is that he said, it's still worth it. You know, I still need to get out there and say this stuff because people may not hear it otherwise. And really, if you think about it, the problem just gets worse. If you just dismiss it, you go, you know what, these people are all hopeless and, you know, they believe lawyers and they believe the media. So, you know, what's the point? But, and I think is what you're getting at is like, we still have to do this, even if it is an unfair fight. But I wanted to move on to this idea of being empathetic to people, because I noticed, and I think I've mentioned this once to you before, but as soon as I found out I had a kid on the way, like overnight, all this stuff I never cared about or totally dismissed as stupid, I suddenly had to take very seriously. So like, you know, can my wife get all the vaccines? Can she get the COVID vaccine? Are pesticides on food really safe? You know, I had a kind of like a moment of crisis where I was like, okay, let me sit down and think, do I really believe all this stuff I've been saying for, you know, 10 years now? And I just, you know, I had to do a little inventory, and I, you know, ended up at the conclusion like, okay, you know, all the reasons that I have been explaining why I don't worry about the Dirty Dozen or whatever, they're valid. It just, I had to go through that. And I go, you know, I totally get why people, especially with no background in science, they see something like that and they're like, oh crap, am I going to poison my kid? You know, I get that now. So I guess the question is, did you have to like develop an ability to empathize with people, or did you just come into your current work just going, hey, I get why you're scared. You know, I totally understand where you're coming from.
No, it did take some empathy, but that came from me testing myself. You see, when I knew everything back when I finished my PhD and I was the smartest guy in the world and no one could tell me otherwise, you know, that was the most dangerous position to be in because I was certain and confident in my ability, yet I was just a beginner. You know, it was the freshly minted black belt syndrome. You know, now all of a sudden you've got all the power in the world, right? But really, it only means that you're at the beginning of your journey. It takes a long time for you to finally admit that you don't know barely anything, but you do have a good toolbox to test everything. And that's what science is about. And so you always are weighing the evidence. And so listening to other people, listening and having empathy, understanding where they're coming from is a really potent way for you to really check yourself. And it sounds like what you were doing. And that's what good scientists or good thinkers need to do. Say, you know, could I be wrong here? And go back and reevaluate. Because it's the people who are so certain and totally cocksure in their positions that are the ones who are most dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, someone made a comment on the article on our site, and it was something to the effect of, you know, I bet the lawyers who bring this litigation, they have such severe cognitive bias because they're so trained to win cases that no matter what the evidence is, no matter how shoddy it is, it's their job to win. And so they pick up on this IARC monograph, or they pick up on some, you know, errant study where they drown rats in glyphosate, and they go, look, see, you know, science. I wonder how big of a problem that is. And I don't think either of us can answer definitively, but I just wonder how that contributes to it. Because, and he says this in the article too, you have lawyers and activists who are really using sick people as pawns in order to bring lawsuits, in order to, you know, forward their environmental campaigns. And it is really disturbing when you think about what they're actually doing.
Yeah. And then cash in, right? Because yeah, it's forwarding their agenda and making a lot of money. I mean, those attorneys who did this made a fortune, as did probably all the people who supported them, like the Aaron Brockoviches and folks who put out these fake stories that are total BS, and without disclosing they were working for the company to recruit people into the suing class, into the in litigating class. And it, for the attorneys, it's all a game. It's about winning that case. And, you know, the people who are, and we think about, let's put a more of a justice spin on this. You have somebody who you know is dead to rights, guilty of the crime they committed. They've admitted it to you, but yet your job is to defend them in court. You know, it is your job to ensure they get a fair trial and for you to look for holes in the case, even though you know that person is guilty. And it's the opposite in this case. They know that there's no evidence that shows glyphosate causes this. And yes, they are using the litigants as pawns. And time will show that. But this is the other reason why it's so important for folks like Jeffrey and, you know, me and others, and, you know, for folks who step into these conversations to do it and do it in visible ways, because his articles will survive time. And when you look at the claims of the secret unknown organism or the Seralini rats or one in two kids having autism by 2021 or whatever, All of that went away, and nobody can repeat those claims. And even the IARC, their claim of glyphosate as a probable carcinogen, that was 6 years ago. And even after 6 years of being described as a probable carcinogen, there has been no definitive evidence to show that it is a carcinogen. And you'd think that at some point that would come out if it was true.
Well, yeah, one would think, right? And I, Jeffrey included in his article, it's a graph of, I believe it's cases of NHL that have been basically flat for the last, I don't know, 30 years. And then glyphosate use, as we've talked about on the show, has just absolutely exploded. So you would think there would be some signal in that data somewhere, and you don't see it. So for all of the rhetoric and all the drama you see, it's I understand why that happens, but you know, you'd think people would see it and they'd go, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't freak out, but I guess that's just not how our minds work.
Yeah, it's not. And that's the other big issue. You know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I think I've said it on this podcast before. It's like saying non-dairy creamer. It doesn't right. say what it is. It says what it isn't. And Hodgkin's lymphoma is one class of lymphoma. It's a little more prevalent than all of these minor forms of lymphatic cancers, such as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's kind of a catch-all for a whole set of different cancers of different etiology. And if there was one that was always going to be prevalent or caused by a single agent like glyphosate, you would see something that would always come up, not as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but as Burkitt's lymphoma or whatever one of these minor lymphomas are. And you would really think of it as farmer's lymphoma or applicator's lymphoma. And that's the other really important point that Cabot makes in this is, what's the denominator when you say that people have been affected? They can get a handful of litigants, hundreds or thousands, but compared to the millions of people and or millions of man hours or whatever applying the stuff, it really is an extremely small number. And, you know, heart goes out to people who are sick, but my heart goes out to them more if they end up being just used so lawyers and activists can profit.
Well, on a related note, is the Biden administration going to ban pesticides that scientists say are safe?
Yeah, this is an interesting article by Hank Campbell, who is from Science 2.0. The idea is, will the Biden administration really follow their mandate of following the science? And in areas like climate and COVID, looks like that's going to happen. And he actually elevated the role of science advisor to a formal cabinet position, which I thought was super cool. And Eric Lander's in there. Eric's a solid scientist. He's been around forever. Don't remember MIT or Whitehead Institute, wherever he is. But he is now the science advisor to the president, which is fantastic. But now the question is, you have groups like the Environmental Working Group and others who are really pressing the administration to ban chemicals and the things farmers use. And so now you get into this funny position where politics and science collide. Are you really going to follow the science when it's politically expedient? And that's the question that the article asks.
I think the answer, and again, being cynical here, I think the answer to that is almost always no, right? I think, and not that there's anything wrong with like being pro-science when it comes to COVID, for example, but I think it's just kind of sexy to say, trust the science right now. And so if you're trying to win a presidential election or you've just won one, you know, that's what you're going to say. And you're going to take a step like this, even if it is good in the long run. But my concern is, it's like when you make issues like this political, like whether or not insects are being wiped out by pesticides, then the other side has to say, well, no, pesticides are great. We love pesticides. We drink pesticides. You know, like it just creates that partisan divide and it makes the issue that much more difficult to tackle. So on those grounds, I would say, you know, let's keep this as apolitical as possible. Let's leave it to the EPA and let's leave it to independent scientists like you, like people that know what they're talking about as much as we can. I realize, you know, in the real world, you're never going to get a perfectly independent scientific enterprise, but you know, the closer we can get to that, I think the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, I agree. But I think we do get that for the most part, because when you look at the cabinet, I'm sorry, the science advisors that are currently employed, it's all folks who, some of them are holdovers from the Trump administration. And some of those were holdovers from the Obama administration. Fauci has been a holdover for since George Bush won, I think. And so it's really, he came in with Clinton, I think. Oh, anyway, he's been around for a while.
Yeah, and 30 years or so.
Yeah, so you do have some folks like, Fauci, Francis Collins, director of NIH. You know, these folks have been around for a while, and they've been in these positions because they've been effective at their scientific jobs and haven't rocked the political boat too much. And I think that's where this really needs to land. At the same time, and along the original question, will the Biden administration keep this ball rolling and keep it, scientific? I think he will. The Obama administration was perfectly fine with many aspects of deregulation of genetically engineered crops and, and chemistry and that kind of stuff. Certainly, the Trump administration didn't get real hard line on a lot of the things farmers used. Certainly the Aqua Advantage salmon got held up politically for a long time during Obama. But in general, I think we should be optimistic, because at the end of the day, folks like Biden are red-blooded capitalists that want to see technology move forward and companies prosper from it and the economy move and all that other good stuff. Farmers do well. Despite what people say. So ultimately, I think we're okay.
Well, color me skeptical. I hope you're right. I really hope you're right. I don't know. Maybe I just distrust the federal government a little more. But with that aside, just for the moment, let's talk about a couple of the scientific aspects of the article. And this is really funny to me. So when people want to show that pesticides are wiping out insects or they're wiping out honeybees, the bee apocalypse, that was the big campaign for probably a decade, I want to say. They'll do studies where they'll have people drive around their neighborhoods, and then they park in their driveway and they see how many bugs splattered on their windshield or their license plate. And this is supposed to give you some kind of an analysis of like how many bugs there are. And these are like volunteers. These aren't scientists. These are just people who are concerned about the environment, I suppose. And then they're self-reporting how many bugs they killed. And when you do higher quality studies that sort of replicate the conditions that bees experience, like on a farm, you don't see the same catastrophic results. So weigh in on that. I think that's a really interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, it was a good point that they make. And, the thing is that when you're talking about insect prevalence and it depends on which kind of insect and where you're looking and so many different factors that go into that. And it's true, there are probably quite a few insects that are being driven to extinction or are less prevalent than there used to be because humans are displacing them. That we're moving and vectoring their competitors around the globe. We're completely destroying natural insect ecology. I mean, the damn honeybee doesn't even belong in North America. So there's it all depends on perspective. Ultimately, all we can really do is do the best we can to take care of the environment and the appropriate ecosystems and do what we can to foster it and care for it. But a lot of factors like insects, it's going to be really difficult to manage them in ways that reflect anything that looks like nature.
Sure, sure. And I should be clear, too. I don't mean to imply that pesticides are these perfectly innocuous substances, because they're not. They're meant to kill things. But it seems like it's just, and again, this goes back to our last story, it's really hard to have a nuanced conversation and say, yeah, this is very toxic and it's meant to be that way, but in the doses it's used, how it's used. And I mean, right. You know this better than I do, for sure. The way farmers use pesticides is very tightly regulated. You can only use it certain times of the year, and the wind has to be like this, and the temperature has to be like this, da 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 da, on and on and on. So it's just challenging to have a conversation and say, yes, that's true, but also this is true. Like, people just seem to struggle with that kind of issue. Like, it just gives them cognitive dissonance.
Well, that's why the ban hammer is so dangerous. When you say you want to ban the chemical, you're taking it away from the farmer. And farmers are using these things in correct ways. Here where I'm at, we would not, you know, we'll use neonics because they're the safest thing you can feed to a fruit tree to protect it from insects. But you wouldn't do it before it blooms because you don't want the bees to be picking up pollen that could potentially cause them physiological problems. But you could use something that is like pyrethroid, one of these contact natural compounds that you could spray to control something like thrips or some other kind of flower-based insect that you might have that could lead to damaged fruit that wouldn't really affect bees. So you make nuanced decisions based upon the tools you have available. And, you know, it really does depend, you know, what the crop is, the time of year, the place, the weather conditions, everything you said.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Well, I guess that's the theme for this week is just pay attention and try to suss things out. It's just not easy to do. I guess that's why shows like this are helpful. But I guess we can leave it there. Who are you following on Twitter, Kevin?
I am following Eric Feigelding, and Eric is, I don't know, you know Eric, or have you read Eric's stuff?
I do. It's another cool last name.
Yeah, it is. He is at Dr. Dr. Eric Ding, D-I-N-G, and he's a really good person to follow for information on COVID-19. He's a little controversial in that he gets a little excited about certain things that he tweets that maybe are not don't have as much gravity as they should. But he's a really effective and persistent person on Twitter. He is an epidemiologist. He's a trained scientist. He works for the for FAS, the Federation of American Scientists or something, but really, really good to follow.
So I'm going to recommend people follow a friend of mine named Luis Ventura. He's actually a big fan of the show now that I think about it, but he's a contributor to the Genetic Literacy Project and Cornell Alliance for Science. And he writes a lot about the anti-GMO movement in Latin America. And one of the themes he's talked about in recent articles is how these groups are basically, they're losing a lot of their influence in North America, and they're sort of migrating from the United States down into Mexico and down into Colombia. And they go down there and they set up little shops and they recruit people. And they say that, you know, Monsanto's coming in and they're trying to destroy your heritage, and they're trying to take over this land that belonged to, you know, your village or your family, so on and so forth. And so he does a great job of documenting, you know, how they're manipulating people in new countries. They're basically like just using the same playbook they have been for 30 years, but they're doing it for people who don't know any better. And so he's done a great job of combating that and talking about, you know, like in Mexico, they're trying to ban glyphosate. And so he's been reporting on that, you know, firsthand. So that's been excellent. So he is at Luis Ventura on Twitter. And I think you will be edified if you follow him.
Very good. Yeah, I think he's really good. When you said that he writes about biotechnology in Latin America, my brain stopped at Latin. And then he writes about it in Latin. Okay.
Biotechnologist Maximus.
My brain just kind of went there when he said that. Very strange. Yeah.
No, he writes in English about biotechnology in Latin America. Anyways, but we're going to call it a day. So follow us on Twitter as well, at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. If you guys are liking the show, please subscribe, retweet it, give us all the stars. And if you're really liking it, consider making a donation. There's a little button at the bottom of each episode. It helps us pay our audio engineer to put these out in high quality and help us promote the show and bring more people in to learn science. So thank you guys so much, and we will see you next week.